All right. So first thing, can you tell us your name, your position at the ECCC, and just a quick summary of your basic responsibilities there?
Sure. My name is Andrew Boyle. I was my last position at the ECCC was as an associate prosecutor in the Office of the Co-Prosecutors. My role there sort of changed. I was there for almost 7 years. Started off as more of a research and writing position and ended more as a trial attorney and appellate attorney and sort of, you know, what have you type of position. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. And what brought you to the ECCC in that role?
Well, I guess I had been working just before I went to the ECCC at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And I was working in the trial chamber there for the judges. And I had, just before going to the ICTR, I had been working for a judge in the United States. So I had a couple of years of working in judicial chambers. I was looking for an opportunity to work in a prosecution office. And that was a position that opened up. I had traveled to Cambodia as a tourist a few years before that, actually a number of years before that. And, you know, found the country interesting and fascinating. And so combination of those two things made me interested in the position.
Perfect. That sounds pretty cool. I'm glad that worked out for you. So tell us a little bit about what you were doing there as a legal officer. Like, what was your day-to-day life like?
I sort of mentioned that my role changed over the time that I was there. I was essentially I was there for the entirety of the first trial in case 2-1. And for that trial, I was essentially a research and writing attorney in the office. And so, you know, on any given day, I might be drafting a motion or a response to a motion or some other sort of legal analysis or portion of a final brief. And for case 2-2, I was a trial attorney. So my roles included, in addition to continuing to do a lot of research and writing in terms of motion practice, in terms of you know, final briefs and that sort of thing, also preparing to examine witnesses and to defend examinations against witnesses, doing a lot of evidence analysis. And then I was also working on cases that were under investigation at the time. And so I was doing evidentiary analysis in those cases, working on disclosure issues and writing both final briefs closing briefs in those investigative cases as well.
Right. Well, it sounds like you had a lot going on there. Can you talk to us about any challenges you faced in your role?
Are you talking about me specifically or the prosecution of the cases, I would guess?
We'd probably be a little more interested in you specifically, but if there are any that you feel, you know, were important to talk about that happened on the prosecution side in general, we'd love to hear about that.
Sure. So, I mean, on a personal side, obviously one of the biggest challenges is language. As a non-Khmer speaker or reader, I was relying a lot on translations of documents and not being able to view and interpret documents that were in their original Khmer and having to sort of rely on that. And we had, you know, excellent translation staff and interpretive staff, but also there was a certain amount of filtering that occurred. And so my inability to speak Khmer was certainly a challenge for me. the other, you know, as the prosecution, we were the only office that was involved across all of the cases, you know, whether you were on the investigative judges or trial judges or Supreme Court judges or a defense team, you were usually involved with, you know, some subset of the cases, whereas the prosecution office is involved across the cases. And so we had extra challenges in having to, you know, keep all of those cases moving forward simultaneously at their various stages and with their various complications. And then just as cases themselves, we had challenges because so much time had passed since the events had occurred. We had witnesses that were no longer able to be located, witnesses whose memories had faded. We had accused persons who were either too ill to be prosecuted or who passed away and so could not be investigated and or prosecuted. You know, there were quite a number of challenges across the board that we had to deal with.
Absolutely. I definitely feel you on the language barrier.
Yeah.
I have not been in Cambodia very long, and I'm definitely feeling that one as well. Let's talk about the hybrid court aspect of the ECCC. What are your thoughts on the positive and the negative aspects of that, or perhaps restrictions or freedoms that you found at the ECCC?
What do you mean by restrictions and freedom?
So I guess considering that it was a hybrid court, you know, there may have been, I guess really just kind of the positive and negative aspects, you know, what worked, what didn't work.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So I think, you know, on the positive side, and I think, it's not exactly an aspect of a hybrid court, that it's located in Cambodia. But I will include that in my answer because I think that that's important. I mean, it's possible to have a non-hybrid court located in the country where the events took place, but it just so happens that the ECCC is both a hybrid court and located in the country where the events took place. I think having a court in the country where the events took place has just myriad benefits in terms of access to evidence, in terms of the public's and victims' ability to interact with the court, in terms of witnesses' ability to interact with the court, in terms of the general public's ability to be educated about the court. You know, I had the opportunity, in addition to, you know, the ECCC had a robust outreach program where it brought a lot of people to view the proceedings at the court. And I would also have the opportunity to go out into various communities and talk about, communities and law schools and things like that, and talk about the work that we were doing there. So that was, a great benefit of having the court in Cambodia. In terms of the hybrid nature, I think that one very positive thing about the hybrid nature is that it forced a certain amount of Cambodian involvement by of Cambodian lawyers and judges and things like that. With an international tribunal that is not a hybrid tribunal, or, you know, hybrid tribunals can be set up in a number of different ways, but the way that the ECCC is set up, there was a certain required number of Cambodian individuals in various offices. And so that ensured that, you know, that there were Cambodian professionals working alongside the international professionals. And I think that that was, you know, largely beneficial because, of course, they have much more direct experience and connection to the events that have taken place because it was in their country. B, they have a better understanding of the legal system and the factual matters. They, you know, obviously speak Khmer, and so, you know, and understand the culture much better. And I also think that it's important to have these professionals involved in the project of international justice. You know, there have been a number of Cambodians that work worked at the court that have gone on to have other roles in the UN as a whole. And I think that that's very, very beneficial. I think that, you know, there is in a hybrid court, you have the benefit of knowledge transfer, not only from in terms of legal matters from the international to the Cambodian side, but also in terms of legal matters from the Cambodian side. The Cambodian, for example, I come out of a common law legal system. The Cambodians are much more familiar with the legal parameters in Cambodia with the civil law legal system. And so I certainly learned a lot from them. I also learned a lot from them about, you know, cultural matters and language matters and things like that. And so it was of great, great benefit to me. On the negative side of hybrid tribunals, you know, it again, there is no one, when you say a hybrid tribunal, that can mean any number of different things. And it's not to say that you can't address any shortcomings and still have a hybrid tribunal. It's not a binary thing. But I do think that sometimes it can create some inefficiencies. I mean, certainly in terms of, you know, there are some roles where you may not need a doubling up or as many, you know, a pairing up of roles and things like that. So I think that efficiency in international courts is always a challenge, whether they're, you know, entirely international or hybrid. And I think that that is always something that needs to be taken into account is, you know, weigh in the scale the benefits of having a hybrid experience that has buy-in from the government, that has buy-in from the community where these events are taking place, but also and that you know creates individuals that can go out into that community and talk to their peers about what is taking place, but also be aware that it's important also to conclude trials and proceedings in a, as you know, in a relatively swift manner, and not to build into a hybrid court a system that is unnecessarily delaying or unnecessarily expensive, or that sort of thing.
Sure, that definitely makes sense. Before we continue, you do me a quick favor.
Sure.
When you're moving the cord coming that has your mic on it, it's creating a little.
Oh, it rustles.
Yeah. So if you know,
I'll just hold it out like this. Is that better?
That works. I mean, you probably don't need to hold it, but if you're knocking it with your hands, I think that's what's causing.
Gotcha.
Feel free to move your hands. Just
okay.
Okay, so thinking a little bit more about the international and the Cambodian sides of things at the ECCC, sometimes the two sides came to different positions during the history of the court.
Yeah.
Comment on any maybe formal or informal ways that the different positions or cultures, you know, maybe were able to find ways to work together.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of formal methodology, that played out in the Office of the Co-Prosecutors essentially through who was signing the documents. You know, if it was a joint filing, as the vast majority of the filings were, certainly in case two, then it was signed by both prosecutors, both the international and the Cambodian prosecutor. And that was outwardly the indication that both prosecutors agree with the content of this, of what's contained in there. Where there were disagreements that couldn't be resolved through, you know, internal conversations and whatever the issue was, if they couldn't be resolved, the co-prosecutors would either submit separate documents, which happened on occasion, or sometimes just the international co-prosecutor would send something in, and it wouldn't have the national co-prosecutor's signature, and vice versa on it. So outwardly, that was sort of an indication of, you know, do they agree, do they disagree about the content of this, even though there wasn't always an explanation. So for example, if only one prosecutor signs a particular document, it's, you know, they don't have to say, you know, we, this is what we disagree about. They can just, you know, to the outside world, it's just that the one of the prosecutors hasn't signed it. Internally, you know, within the prosecution office, I found the communication was very, very good. We often, you know, of course, we would have to complete filings that were going to be submitted by the prosecution office well in advance of the deadline, so that we had an opportunity to share with and to engage with Cambodian counterparts to sort of give them a chance to review the materials and, you know, give them a chance to say yes or we're fine with this, or no, we're uncomfortable with this. So that, you know, just building in a certain amount of time to allow both sides to review the material was certainly necessary. And sometimes it was just a matter of if there was confusion about an issue or exactly what we were saying in a document, then having those conversations. And sometimes those conversations were fruitful and everyone was satisfied that we could be on board with what was being filed, and sometimes there weren't, and we just had to agree to sort of disagree and proceed on that basis. But at the same time, recognizing that, you know, no one thing was going to sort of define any case. And so even when we, the few occasions where we disagreed on matters, or where the co-prosecutors disagreed on matters, you know, we continued to work very closely on other issues.
Right. So this is not the first international tribunal you've worked on. As you mentioned, you were also in the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. How would you compare your experiences there to your experiences at the ECCC?
My experiences at the ICTR were very different for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, as I mentioned, I was in a judiciary office at the ICTR as opposed to being a prosecutor. And so, of course, for all of the reasons that being a judge is different from being a prosecutor, that sort of, you know, is the same. You approach the material different, your role is different, that sort of thing. I was also at the ECCC much longer than I was at the ICTR, and so I became much more familiar with the underlying facts and the process there. The ICTR was an entirely international court. It was not a hybrid court, and therefore, you know, it didn't have that aspect of the hybrid, you know, relying on Cambodian law or relying on Rwandan law as much. It was relying almost solely on international law. So that was a big difference. The factual basis was very different in the two. It was very different in the two courts. In the Rwanda case, you know, there was a lot of testimony, but there wasn't a lot of, or the Rwandan court, there was a lot of testimony. There wasn't a lot of physical evidence in terms of hard documents from that time. In the Cambodian context, we had a lot of documents from the Khmer Rouge itself. Obviously, the fact patterns are completely different in terms of how the various criminal acts unfolded and all of that, in terms of who, you know, who was responsible and those sorts of things. I think, you know, aside from the fact that they were both dealing with crimes against humanity and genocide, they were vastly different. Of course, in some ways, they rely on similar case law. I mean, at the ECCC, we also would look to the ICTR case law and the ICTY case law as instructive, just as the ICTR looked to the ICTY and that sort of stuff. So I would say that there are probably more differences than there were similarities between the two courts.
Sure. No, that absolutely makes sense.
And the other big difference, of course, is that the ICTR was not based in Rwanda. The ICTR was based in Tanzania. So although there would be missions processes that would be carried out in Rwanda, it was not based in the community where the events took place.
Got it. So you mentioned that one of the few similarities is that at the ECCC, we're kind of looking back at some of what was done in Rwanda to think about moving forward. Moving forward from here, are there any lessons learned or best practices or recommendations for future tribunals that you kind of stand out for you from your time at the ECCC?
Certainly, gathering evidence as soon as possible is important. I mean, I think that is something that we have seen now with some of these investigative mechanisms. There's been an investigative mechanism set up for Syria. There's one in the process of being set up for Myanmar, these mechanisms will be gathering evidence even in circumstances where there isn't a court that, it's not to say that this evidence is never, those that evidence will never be used in any court systems. And, there are certain case trials, but there's no court that's dealing comprehensively with all the crimes that took place there. But at least the evidence is being gathered and will be on hand if that ever becomes possible. So I think that is a great lesson to learn. I also think that starting the trials as soon as possible is important. Choosing efficiently what crimes to charge and what cases to bring, particularly if you're dealing with a huge crime base, and recognizing that there will be real world constraints on any court proceeding in terms of money, in terms of time and things like that, and trying to be selective about what are the crimes that are most important, what are the easy, what are the strongest crimes that you have a factual basis for, so you're not trying to do too much. Of course, it's always important to represent the full criminality of what transpired, but to keep in mind that that there are other pressures on any particular court, I think is also important, and just making sure that the process is carried out as efficiently as possible, and as fairly as possible.
Absolutely. Are there any opportunities or tasks that you think the ECCC should accomplish, but maybe haven't, either because of legal impediments or other issues?
Sure. Coming from a prosecution perspective, as can be read in our filings, I think that we are speaking today in 2019. In July of 2019, before all of the proceedings in the cases under investigation have concluded. So I don't know exactly what's going to happen with all of those cases. There are a number that are still awaiting decision, a number of those cases still awaiting decision from the pretrial chamber, but there are, I would have liked to see, and I hope that I do see some of those cases go to trial. Even more, and again, along the lines of, I wish the court had been set up sooner, and I understand all the reasons why it wasn't. But if I had sort of my choice in the matter, it would have been set up sooner because there would have been more people that could have been prosecuted, while they were still alive or still able to be prosecuted. And so I think that would have been beneficial. Aside from the judicial aspect of it, I think that the most important thing that I would like to see now going forward is making the materials that were amassed during the investigations of these cases freely available and easily accessible online to the general public. I think that, you know, whatever one thinks about the ECCC and about any particular case and those issues, an undeniable benefit of the whole process has been that there is exponentially more information about what occurred during the Khmer Rouge era than there was before. You know, some of the sort of seminal books about the Khmer Rouge era need to have substantial portions of them rewritten based on the additional information that has come out from these investigations, much of which is still, a lot of which is available, is unclassified, some of which is still classified just because the investigations in a civil law legal system are confidential. But I very much think it's important that all of that evidence, except for, you know, the rare occasion where someone fears retribution and has a proven fear of retribution or private medical issues or something like that, be made available, because it will, it is an absolute treasure trove of information to study what happened during the Khmer Rouge era, and to better understand how the Khmer Rouge worked, how what democratic Cambodia was like, you know, what experiences people had, and of course, I think it's important that that be not only, you know, completely free and completely available. All of it, for I'll mention, has been digitized already. So the hard part has been done. It's all been digitized. It's just a matter of putting it online. And I think it's important that it be online so that you don't have to travel to a room in Phnom Penh in order to do this research. I think that people should be able to access this. And all, you know, of course, much of it has also been translated into a couple of other languages, allowing researchers who don't have Khmer language ability, who don't have and if you speak French and don't speak English, you know, a lot of it has also been translated into French. So if I got one wish, it would be that as soon as possible, all of that evidence is placed online so that researchers can start engaging with it. Just while I was talking about that, and I was talking about how the investigations are confidential, it made me remember something that you had asked about earlier. And I would add to the list of things that I would prefer to see. This has not as much to do with a hybrid tribunal, but more to do with the civil law system, which is that I think understanding the interests behind having confidential investigations within a civil law system, and you know, taking no position on how that might be beneficial within cases when you're dealing with domestic criminal cases, say in France, maybe one or two people. I think that by and large, the excessive amount of secrecy in the investigations or confidentiality during the investigation period is of detriment to the project of international justice. And I say this because I think that the investigations carry on, the investigative phases in these cases carried on for years. They And then during that time, there was very little that the public understood about what was happening. There was frustration, you know, on behalf of a lot of the public because of that. And I think that the purposes of international justice demand more transparency to so that the international community and the Cambodian community writ large can understand what is being carried out in these investigations. I think that sort of in terms of other aspects of how that process played out that I think should be remedied, you know, and essentially at the way that the process worked at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, you had a extensive investigatory period followed by a lengthy trial, assuming something went to trial. And I think that there needs to be a way to certainly shorten the total period. And that would require either shortening the trial or shortening the investigative period, because I think that there was some doubling up that occurred in regards to having such an extensive investigative period and then such an extensive trial as well.
Definitely. Thank you for that. I think here at the Documentation Center of Cambodia, we would agree that having as much out in the public view would be great for us as well. And we're hoping that these interviews will help to contribute to getting at least some of that knowledge out there. So thank you for joining us to do that.
Yeah.
Based on your time at the ACCC, what challenges do you see for future courts handling mass atrocities?
It ranges. I mean, you know, I think that writ large, future courts handling mass atrocities, I think a lot of people feel like that the outlook now is a little bit bleaker than it was, say, in the mid to late 90s. You know, you had the ECCC under consideration and the ICTY being set up and the ICTR and the ICC. It was sort of the heyday of international criminal justice. And that's not to say that's gone away. I mean, we see recently a Kosovo court being set up. We see these investigative mechanisms being set up. But I think that, you know, there's also a lot of criticism of the ICC, and I don't know that there is as much widespread support for international criminal justice as there was in the recent past. And I think that, you know, it's incumbent on those of us in the community to sort of talk about the importance and to explain the necessity of this of these types of courts to make sure that they are supported internationally. I mean, that, you know, there was a long time where the ECCC had severe financial problems, had trouble because at least until relatively recently, it was funded entirely by donations. From participating countries. And so it was a constant effort to try to get countries to donate money to support the court, and that sometimes there would be shortfalls and some of the Cambodian staff weren't getting paid, which is obviously no way to treat your employees and not fair. You know, these courts need to be set up with secure funding mechanisms so that isn't sort of a constant concern. I think that one of the ways that we see international criminal justice changing is through technology. It's interesting because, you know, we had, and you know, some other international courts have some video and some wiretaps, and we had a little bit of video from the Khmer Rouge time that was in evidence. But going forward, places like we talked about the Syria investigative mechanism, the Myanmar investigative mechanism, they are going to have reams and reams of things like Facebook posts from individuals that are leading events in those countries that are going to be in evidence, and they're going to have to, you know, be able to be on top of that evidence. Evidence management is and the ability to access and understand the evidence that you have is a crucial tool for any office. I think that we benefited in the prosecution office from a strong and robust evidence management program, where we were, it took some getting used to, but we were able to identify relevant evidence and obtain it in our system pretty quickly. There's just no way that you can keep it all in your head. And so you have to have an evidence management system that allows querying of the evidence. And so when you need something, you can find it, and you can find it quickly, and you can make those connections between different parts of evidence. And that is something that, future courts are going to have to prioritize, is making sure that they are on top, because they're going to have so much more. They're going to have, videos posted to YouTube of executions and lots of interviews with, witnesses and victims and perpetrators and that sort of thing. I think that in terms of, going forward, the important thing is to find, I think that those of us working in international criminal justice need to find ways to improve international criminal justice, making sure that it's as efficient and cost-effective as possible, but also communicate better about the importance of international criminal justice, and making sure that these types of institutions continue to have international support.
Yeah, following up on that a little. So you mentioned that it seems like there's less support for international tribunals now than there was, say, 20 years ago. And I'm wondering if you can speak to why that is. I know with the ECCC in particular, some people have thought, perhaps the time and funding that went into this might have been better spent just trying to help the victims instead of convicting a few people at the top. Why do you think that support has gone down? And do you have any thoughts on how it could be built back up?
Yeah, I think some of it is just sort of historical. Coming out of the Cold War, there was a lot of positive thinking about the international community. That the Cold War was over. It's quote unquote the end of history, and now we can just focus on, on these grand international programmatic efforts that, had only been sort of talked about for a while. And I think partly we're past, there is certainly a more splintering that is happening now. The it's not that we're all going to get to ride off into the sunset. I think, there's more division within the international community than there was potentially in sort of the mid to late 90s. And I think also that the fact of the matter is that, a lot of these institutions were being set up, and they were relatively untested. And so now a natural part of getting something set up is sort of growing pains, and there are going to be failures. And I think in terms of, now that people see that it's not always going to be successes, that there are going to be some setbacks and things like that, people sort of focus on that as opposed to the good. And I think that there are other actors that for various reasons benefit from denigrating both international projects, international justice projects. Either they benefit themselves, or they benefit from an international community that does not cohere around ideas of international justice. And so they are actively out there. And I think that you know, often the folks that are working on international justice, they're focused on doing their jobs and they're not as much out there saying, like, this is why international justice is important. That's not to say that there's no one doing that. I think that's, you know, coming as an American, I think that's an important part of the ambassadorial position that was set up under President Clinton, focused entirely on international criminal justice. It was to have, an American mouthpiece that was, their role was to say, we support these mechanisms and we're going to engage with them. And, you know, autocrats and human rights violators around the world be on warning. And I think that, I think also that in some ways, and I experienced this a bit at the ECCC, and I think that, you know, criticism plays a strong role, is an important part of, by whether it's civil society or other members of the community, criticism is a strong role of getting feedback and saying, okay, this is what we're doing right, or this is what we're doing wrong. But I also think that nobody really writes a report that says, you know, this is pretty good. The people, if you write a report that says these are the criticisms, people think that you're a deep thinker because you've identified flaws. There isn't, on the other side, people that are sort of like, oh, this person's a deep thinker because he thinks that overall, or she thinks overall, this was a worthwhile project. So I think that it's kind of a one-way ratchet in some ways. But at the same time, I'm not despairing, because I do see the international community continue, even in, you know, even in the face of not having a court to deal with Syria, being like, okay, well, we're not just going to be like, we can't do anything about it. We're going to set up an investigative mechanism. We're going to gather that information. And I think that international criminal justice is now accepted. It's no longer an experiment. I think it's an understood part of the international legal fabric. And now it's more about figuring out, you know, what design is best for any particular area. And I don't think that any one design is going to be a sort of cookie cutter thing that you can fit onto any particular conflict. I think that you have to, you know, thoughtful people have to consider, you know, the courts that have come before, their successes and their flaws, and think about how those dynamics work in regards to any particular conflict, and try to find something that works for that conflict.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting concept to think about. And as you mentioned, some people are starting to investigate places like Syria and Myanmar. One of our other interviewees, Nicholas Kimjian, who I think was on your team as well, is heading over to do some of that work in Myanmar. And I'll be very anxious to see how that plays out.
Yeah.
So moving back to the ECCC a bit, keeping within the boundaries of what's been released to the public, of course, are there any accused or survivor stories that really resonated with you while you were working on the trials?
I mean, there were a lot of stories that resonated with me. Some were survivor stories. I spent a lot of time working on issues related to the persecution and genocide of the Cham. and so some of those witnesses, you know, for natural reasons, I spend a lot more time on witnesses that I was going to be questioning in court, and so would look very deeply into their stories. You know, the ways that the persecution was carried out against the Cham particularly affected me, because these people were not only being treated in inhumane ways, but also being targeted based on sort of who they were and who they identified as. So that really affected me. Anything having to do with children as victims very much affected me. It affected me when, some victims and civil parties would talk about how important it was for them to have the opportunity to tell their story in court. I was across the board impressed with the courage of victims talking about being able to talk about atrocious things that happened to them, sometimes very private thing. You know, we would have both men and women talking about being forcibly married, sometimes raped, and willing to come, you know, sometimes coming to a very strange place and sitting in front of foreigners and Cambodians with a lot of lights on them and tell these very private stories in order to help the case was incredibly moving. At the same time, on the other side, I was very struck sometimes by some of the perpetrators. You had some perpetrators that I felt were being less than honest in what they were talking about, but you also had perpetrators that clearly, it struck me to try to think what it must be like for them. I remember questioning essentially a torturer who used to work at S21, the Toll Slaying prison center, who was willing to talk about the things that he did to people. And it struck me about what that must be like to sort of admit in public that you did these things to other people. I think to single out any individual witness is, to me, would feel a little bit unfair, in part because I don't have at my instant recollection all of the witnesses that came through, particularly the victims, but also because, that they all had their individual stories to tell, and they all lost family members, lost children, witnessed horrible things. And I think that is, they are sort of the victims are sort of the real heroes of the court process. The cases would never hold together without those witnesses, and for them to come in and tell their stories, even when it was clear that it was often incredibly painful. I mean, I remember questioning witnesses and having to pause because the witness was breaking down on the stand, recalling these things and being forced to talk about them, and being offering to say we could, take a break, and them saying, no, I want to keep going. So, I mean, almost across the board, incredibly impressed by the victims and witnesses to these atrocities and some, in a sort of the odd circumstances of the Khmer Rouge court, you sometimes had perpetrators that ended up being victims themselves. And so you have these strange aspects where former Khmer Rouge members then ended up being targeted, and then they are victims. So it's a complex issue.
Absolutely. Looking forward, what do you think the major impacts of the ACCC will be on Cambodian society now, and also, say, 20 years from now?
I think in terms of what the impacts of the ACCC will be now, I think that it's raised the visibility of the Khmer Rouge era within the community within Cambodia. I know that, various groups have been doing more education about, genocide and what transpired and things like that. And I think that also there are a number of professionals, Cambodian legal professionals that have worked at the ECCC and gone on to go back to work in various aspects of, you know, whether it's private practice or Cambodian government. And I hope that they are bringing with them some of the lessons learned from the court. In terms of 20 years from now, I think I'd really just go back to that this will prevent the information and evidence that's been gathered will present a much clearer picture of what transpired. As one, you know, sort of simple thing, the Office of the Co-Prosecutors, you know, we started off, I think, when I arrived, we had a list of somewhere around 11,000 victims, individual victims that had passed through S21. And through a lot of work by a lot of people, not just in the prosecution office, but also in other offices. By the time I left, there was a list of over 18,000 individuals that had passed through S21. And that's just one example of how there's a much more robust picture of what took place during the Khmer Rouge time. So I hope in 20 years, the understood story of the Khmer Rouge and what took place during Democratic Kampuchea is informed by the evidence that was gathered at the ECCC.
Right. Well, thank you so much for all of this. Before we wrap up, is there anything that we haven't talked about that you think is important that for us to discuss?
No, I don't think so. I mean, if you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer them. This, you know, it's an interesting court. It's an interesting historical period. It's significant, I think, because for a lot of different reasons, but it's also, if you look temporally, sort of the Nuremberg trials after World War II, this is the next most recent, the next time period that's dealt with by international court is the ECCC. So it's, in some ways, the first word on where was the law before, you know, before these other atrocities took place in the 90s that were dealt with by these courts. So that on a legal basis is very important. But there's so much that could be said about the ECCC and the court and the cases that have gone on there and that are still going on there. But maybe there will be other opportunities in the future.
Absolutely. Well, great. Thank you so much again for speaking with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.